Rivals is a production of iHeartRadio. Hey everyone, this is Rivals, a show about music rivalries and beefs and feuds and long simmering tensions between pop musicians. My name is Stephen Hayden. I'm one of the hosts of this show, and this is my co-host.
My name is Jordan Runtuck.
This is our first episode. I think we have approximately 10,000 rivalries on our master list already, don't we? I mean, it's a huge list.
A massive list.
So we're excited to get into everything. I wish we could talk about 10,000 rivalries just in this episode, but this episode would be like 15 hours long, and I don't think anyone would listen to that. We would listen. We'd probably die in the middle of it, though, and it'd just be dead air. So we're excited to get into the show. You might be wondering, like, why do we want to hear these guys talk about music rivalries?
Or who the hell are we?
What are your qualifications? Show us your papers. You know, let's get into it. Well, I wrote a book.
You wrote the book on music rivalries.
It's called Your Favorite Band is Killing Me, and it came out a couple years ago. I wrote a book about music rivalries just because I love music rivalries. I think they're fascinating. Yeah, conflict. You have famous people, hilarious anecdotes about people getting really angry, which, you know, is always
classic.
Always classic comedy gold. I also feel like the reason why we as music fans tend to be attracted to beefs and feuds and all these rivalries is that they sort of reflect our own need to kind of work out our issues in different ways. You know, like we look at these artists who exist in the same lane, but maybe they're different in some crucial way. We pit them against each other because really those people signify opposing ideas. And instead of fighting wars over these ideas, we talk about it by either talking about celebrities or sports teams or whatever the case may be.
It's a philosophical debate, but with much better clothes and better looking.
Absolutely. Great way to put it. So I know that I'm qualified to talk about this, but what are you doing here, Jordan?
What in the hell are you doing here, man? I do my best. I am a music editor at People Magazine and a contributing writer at Rolling Stone. And before that, I was at VH1 for a number of years. I have not written the book on music rivalries, but I've talked to some of the people involved. I've profiled Paul McCartney, Ringo Starr, David Crosby, David Byrne, people all at the heart of famous musical feuds. So, yeah, happy to bring some of that here.
I'm very excited about the rivalry we're going to be talking about today. I feel like most of the times on this show, we're going to be talking about rivalries between artists or bands. And that's always cool. But to me, like, the best rivalries actually exist within bands.
Oh, absolutely.
The intra-band rivalries. Because it's like, you can't really generate a good hatred for somebody unless you work with them.
Or it's like being in the back of a tour bus for, you know, hours at a time for years. Yes.
And the rivalry we're going to be talking about today, I think, is like one of the all-time great intra-band rivalries, maybe the greatest.
I would argue.
Is it the greatest?
I think so, because you got the romantic edge just kicks it over.
All right, well, we're talking about Lindsey Buckingham versus Stevie Nicks.
Bring it on.
And Fleetwood Mac.
Okay, let's dive into this battle.
Fleetwood Mac has like a long, crazy history, lots of different band members. The only constants are Mick Fleetwood and John McVie,
the Fleetwood Mac,
the rhythm section. But like, how did Lindsey Buckingham and Stevie Nicks end up in the same band? Like, you know that story.
Well, the best part sort of is that, you know, rumors and all this, people know that's just the tip of the iceberg. That's sort of the end of their relationship. Stevie and Lindsey were high school friends.
Didn't they meet like at a religious thing?
Yeah, it was like a Young Life, and they sang like Mamas and the Papas songs or something. Yeah.
It's like the two like sexiest, druggiest rock stars. They met at church. Right. I love it.
They were in a band in high school called Fritz, and they were actually a decent-sized band. They opened for, like, Jimi Hendrix and Janis Joplin, which apparently, as Stevie says later, was kind of where she developed her style with the feathers and, you know, the gauzy scarves and stuff. And they eventually split the band in 71, tried to make it big and moved to L.A., and that's actually when they first became like a romantic item. And Stevie said later, like, you know, she went out and got all these jobs as like a waitress and a housekeeper and stuff. And then she'd come home and Lindsey would be stoned out of his mind. And she would like, you know, be passed out and she would like move his legs and like clean up where he was and everything. And they went to Sound City and recorded their duo album, Buckingham Nicks.
Amazing album.
Well, the thing about the album cover is actually, it's really kind of one of the first huge cracks in the relationship, and it was a sore point for Stevie for years to come. They were both totally broke. She spent something like her last $100 on this white blouse, and they're taking the photo, and the photographer said, "No, it's not quite sexy enough. Can you take that blouse off?" She really didn't want to, and Lindsay just jumps down her throat. "Oh, come on, you're being a child. Why are you being so paranoid? It's art." And she really was coerced into taking her blouse off, and it really upset her. It was a huge sticking point in their relationship. I think it really sowed the seeds for their, you know.
Yeah, if you're a boyfriend, you gotta, like, step in when the photographer says to your girlfriend, "Take your blouse off." Don't be on the photographer's side in that situation.
Yeah, no, never good.
Side with your woman. Let her keep the blouse on. But anyway, that's a great record.
Great record. It totally tanked. And Stevie was thinking about quitting music after it tanked, actually. But the good thing that came of it was that when they were in Sound City recording, Mick Fleetwood heard Lindsey Buckingham recording guitar solo. Mick Fleetwood, obviously drummer in Fleetwood Mac. Bob Welsh, the Fleetwood Mac guitarist, had just left and they were looking for a new guitarist. So he tracked down Lindsey and asked him to join the band.
But just Lindsey.
Just Lindsey. And Lindsey said, "Well, you know, I've... we're sort of a package deal. You got to bring my girlfriend Stevie too." And they kind of had, I guess she showed up at an audition straight from work wearing a waitress outfit, and they had a little audition and then famously went to dinner, I think on New Year's Eve or something in 1974 at a Mexican restaurant. And that was kind of how the band started, the famous classic lineup. And they started recording
the self-titled White Album record. And the big single from there is by the girlfriend who had to be forced into the band, Rhiannon, which is like, you know, and that album and that song kind of kicked that album into the stratosphere. And I think that record sold like 4 million copies, which was like astronomical for the mid-70s.
Oh, a ton, yeah. And I mean, that and Landslide, too, were the two biggest songs on that album.
So Stevie's already kind of writing like a lot of the big hits.
Yeah, and Lindsey's not real happy about that.
Although Lindsey is an important contributor to her songs. He's kind of important on the arrangement and production side, but Stevie is still the big star.
And he loved Neginer. I mean, I guess when they started recording their next album, it was going to be Rumors, he said that she needed him to make her song sound, quote, halfway decent.
Right.
Which is a great, you know, great line.
Well, and their relationship was starting to fall apart.
Oh, Rumors. I mean, everyone knows the Rumors soap opera of everybody.
Well, you have Lindsey Buckingham and Stevie Nicks breaking up, and you have
John McVie and Christine McVie
breaking up. Of course, the difference in the McVie situation is that John McVie isn't a songwriter, so you only get one side of that relationship.
Right.
You have Christine McVie writing You Make Loving Fun, which I believe is about Christine McVie having sex with the lighting director from Fleetwood Mac, which, to John McVie's credit, plays a sick bass line on that song, even though, you know, you'd think, "All right, honey, this is not a nice thing to make me play on. I know that you're singing about having sex with the lighting director here." But John McVie, the consummate professional, he does it. But, you know, you can't really read into his bass lines. You know, there's nothing confessional about his bass lines. But then
You can feel the pain.
They're very deep and heavy. Stevie and Lindsey, however, you hear both sides of their... And you have...
all over that record.
Exactly. And you have, Stevie writing Dreams, which...
In Sly Stone's bed.
Did you know that? Oh, believe me, I own the classic albums documentary on Blu-ray, by the way. I needed high
def. You love Blu-ray.
Oh, I love Blu-ray.
Wow.
So you have Stevie writing Dreams, which is, I think, kind of a tender breakup song.
Yeah, I mean, it's much nicer than Going Your Own Way.
Yeah, Lindsey is writing Go Your Own Way, because, like, Stevie... In Dreams, it's more of sort of like a Zen idea that like
players only love you
when they're playing, which is kind of like a diss, I guess. But like, I feel like the overall vibe of that song is like, you'll get over it.
Yeah,
you know, women may come, women will go. Mm. When the rain washes you free, you'll know. Like this idea that you'll be purified by nature, I guess. Like when you have a horrible breakup, and then you have Lindsey Buckingham essentially calling Stevie Nicks a slut.
Yeah, and packing
going
up and shacking up.
And Never Going Back Again, another Lindsey Buckingham song, kind of a bitter song. Like it kind of fronts as like him trying to reconcile his feelings about the breakup, but it's also kind of jabbing at Stevie a little bit. And of course, the big Stevie Nicks song that doesn't end up on the record is Silver Springs.
Which is really sort of the theme in a lot of ways to their relationship. It crops up again and again in their story. It's really interesting. I mean, she wrote it as sort of a tender but also kind of vengeful postmortem of their relationship. And she wrote it. She really felt strongly about the song. And also, she wrote it as a gift to her mother, too. She was going to give her the song rights to it. And so she really wanted it on the album. And the band, for reasons that kind of seem not, you know,
well, the idea
not
was,
terribly, but it was too long.
Yeah, the
too
idea
slow.
Was that, like, yeah, because Silver Springs was supposed to be on Rumors, but then there was this idea that, like, the album is too long. We have to cut a song. And there's also, like, a lot of ballads already on this record. So they decided to put on I Don't Want to Know. She later said that she recorded that song with a gun to her head. I don't think that means literally, but like in the figurative sense, she felt like she had a gun to her head when she did that song.
They did the backing track without her and not telling her, and then took her out to the parking lot and said, hey, well, here's the deal with Silver Springs. You got to sing this song. And they made Mick Fleetwood tell her because he's, you know, the unofficial leader, I guess official leader. And she went berserk. And then, yeah, as you said, just recorded it with a, you know, metaphorical gun to her head. But, and it bugged her forever.
Yeah, well, going back to Silver Springs, it's interesting to contrast that with Go Your Own Way, because Go Your Own Way is this incredibly bitter song, clearly about Stevie Nicks. And, you know, Stevie Nicks had this quote about, like, every time Lindsey Buckingham would sing the part about packing up and checking up is all you want to do. It's like, I wanted
to kill him.
Yeah, I wanted to go over there and kill him. He knew it. He really pushed my buttons through that. It was like, I'll make you suffer for leaving me. And I did.
But then, which is great. It's like some Fatal Attraction. Like,
but then Stevie Nicks, though, she had an interview that she did in 97 where she said that when she wrote Silver Springs, the idea was like, and this is the quote from an interview that she did. She said, I'm so angry with you. You will listen to me on the radio for the rest of your life. And it will bug you. I hope it bugs you. Because you listen to the lyrics of that song and like,
you can't escape the sound
of the woman who loves you.
And like, my voice will haunt you.
And of course, you know, that song, it was left off of Rumors.
It was the B-side for Go Your Own Way, which is just the ultimate indignity for her. It's got to
exactly.
be the B-side for the song slagging her off.
Right.
We're
going to put you on the B-side. And like, you know, and again, like you said, Stevie thought, okay, I'm going to give the royalties for this song to my mother. And it's going to be a big, you know.
Big deal.
A big payday for her. But then
the song didn't really sell.
Yeah,
they
put it on the single and it didn't make nearly as, it would have made a ton more money if it had been
on Rumor. Yeah, I mean, one of the best-selling albums of all time, yeah.
But then there's that sequel to this story. In 97, they end up reuniting, the classic lineup of Fleetwood Mac, end up reuniting for the dance. And by the way, do you know how Stevie Nicks and Lindsey Buckingham got back together?
Twister.
Yes.
My favorite things, Natural Disasters, Bill Paxton, and Fleetwood Mac. My three favorite things.
They did a song for the Twister soundtrack in 1996 called Twisted.
I want to know what a business meeting. Okay, we got this movie. It's about a storm. Cows fly through the air. We got Helen Hunt. We got Paxton. What else do we... What do we need? Oh.
We need
Fleetwood Mac.
Yeah, we need the most tumultuous couple in rock history.
What do you mean?
To record a song that is just a slight variation on the title of the movie. I'm imagining like other blockbusters from the 90s, like if you would have had
Titanic
or in Armageddon. But that brings Stevie and Lindsey back together. They kind of brings them back into the fold of Fleetwood Mac. And Silver Springs ends up being sort of the breakout song from the dance, because it's like
a deep cut before that.
Deep cut. Most people didn't know the song. I know personally, I'd never heard the song before it was in the dance. And the thing that people always remember from the television special of the dance Fleetwood Mac playing Silver Springs, because it culminates with like 2 minutes of like Stevie Nicks and Lindsey Buckingham.
Down.
I don't know if they're like, I murdering each other or I like fucking each other. It's like one of the two, like the same
time. Yeah.
And like there's a part, because like, you know, that song, it's an amazing song because it just builds and builds and builds. And
Lindsey looks terrified, I have to say.
Lindsey looks terrified, but he's holding his ground. He's like, he doesn't break the stare, which is very ballsy.
Or the chain.
I would never do it. Because like as the song progresses, Stevie basically like starts walking toward him and like shouting the chorus, like, you know, shouting the end lyrics of the song. And like shouting at him that like, you'll never forget me. Like, I will always haunt your dreams. You know, I will be the woman you never get over. Like, that's the message of the end of this song. And Lindsey is he's rattled, but you also feel like, oh, maybe he's kind of turned on by this. because he's like not breaking a stare and he's like giving it back to her. So it's like, wow. You know, I mean, this is the amazing thing about this relationship. And, you know, there's other twists and turns that came after this, but like.
And before.
We all have that ex in our life who is like the main ex, the number one ex, you know, the person who maybe they were the first person to break your heart. Maybe you almost came close to like marrying that person. Maybe you divorced that person. But in most cases, you never see that person again, or like you maybe see them occasionally. You don't work with them. You know, they're not a part of your life.
They're the person that every time something cool happens to you, you do something cool, you think, wow, I wish this person could see this right now.
Exactly. So I rubbed in their face.
Right.
So I could like spike the ball in the face. But it's always an imagined thing. Like you don't actually, maybe you look them up on Facebook or something. That's as close as you get to them. And I think what is so crazy about Fleetwood Mac, and we all know this, of course, I mean, the attraction of this band is that like these two people were forced to be in the same proximity for 40 years. And it's so fucked up that they had to do that. But it's amazing. It's
it
like,
is,
but so it's, dramatic.
It is really fucked up, but also it's cool because then, you know, every amazing song that the other one presents is just like spiking the ball in the face of the other person. It's the best and the worst of both.
Yeah. To me, it's mostly the worst.
Mostly the worst.
I think it's better. You want to spike it in your brain. You don't actually want
you're
them
right. Yeah,
in your
fair.
Proximity. But the other
you're thing, a lot better adjusted than I am.
Yeah, maybe so. I mean, they have that toxic element to their relationship, but there's also the reality that they sort of need each other in order to completely fulfill their sort of artistic potential. And there is sort of like a functional dysfunctionality to their relationship, obviously, because it resulted in all this hugely successful, popular, beloved music, you know, that multiple generations enjoy.
All right, hang on. We'll be right back with more Rivals.
Do you know much about the Tango in the Night sessions?
Yes, I was actually, I was about to bring that up.
This is like one of my favorite periods of their relationship because it is like the ultimate sour and sweet situation, like where you feel like, what in the hell were they still doing in each other's lives? But then you're also like, oh, they kind of needed each other too at the same time. But it's like the worst example of that. Because like, you know, it's like Stevie Nicks was like, she was like in a bad way.
She was in rough shape.
She was like coming out of rehab.
And been overprescribed Klonopin and just was really, I mean, she said later, I mean, she lost years of her life in that. And I guess when they were doing Tango in the Night, apparently Lindsey Buckingham installed like a Winnebago at the end of the driveway of the studio so that I think Mick Fleetwood and Stevie could go and indulge in private so we didn't have to deal with it.
She went to rehab for cocaine addiction. And I mean, was that before the sessions?
I think it was just before. Yeah, I think
just
when
before.
She got out. Yeah.
And then you said, yeah, she was prescribed Klonopin as, I don't know what, as like an anti-anxiety, which like you're taking Klonopin? Like,
quite a bit of it.
So she's like incoherent a lot of the time. And I know like one thing that Stevie Nicks has talked about during the Tango in the Night sessions, like she's conceded that she was not in good shape. A lot of the vocals that she was laying down ended up being erased by Lindsey Buckingham because Buckingham was producing the record.
And she said, I mean, her quote was, I'm sure they totally sucked.
I'm sure they totally sucked. Yeah. But then she also talked about the fact that, like, you know, Lindsey Buckingham was making this record at his house. And
the vocal booth was in his bedroom.
The vocal booth was in the bedroom, like his bedroom. And again, this kind of goes back to that idea of, like, you have an ex.
Yeah. Don't invite them to your bedroom.
Exactly. The biggest ex of your life. And now you're in their bedroom again. And you know that there's kind of, you know, they've moved on. They have another person in their life. And like, you're over them, but like, you never totally get over something like that, especially if you have to be around them all the time. So it's extremely fraught and it's a mess. And like, I think that Lindsey Buckingham ended up having to like stitch vocal takes together.
Yeah. Yeah. It's like, not full takes.
But like Stevie Nicks is barely on that record.
I said something like, they spent a year on it. She was there for like 3 weeks or something, I think is what he said later. I mean, that whole period, I mean, he ended up quitting right after. I didn't go on the tour to promote it. And they had, it was in, I think it was Stephen Davis's biography, Gold Dust Woman from, I think, 2 years ago, where they had some kind of physical altercation where Lindsey apparently threw over the hood of his car or something. And,
well, that
and
was,
the band intervened.
I think that was like in Mick Fleetwood's book.
Oh, okay. It might have been in both, but yeah.
Because I know, I think Stevie and Lindsay denied that later, that there was some physical thing. But yeah, I know, in Mick Fleetwood's book, he talked that there was some sort of, physical altercation at the end of the Tango in the Night era, and that sort of led to Lindsay Buckingham leaving the band. I got to say, though, Tango in the Night, great record. I love that album.
I'm more of a Mirage guy.
What?
I'm more of a Mirage guy. Controversial opinion.
Well, you can be a Mirage guy and also say Tango in the Night is a banger, man.
No, you're right. You're right.
Tango in the Night also is weird because it's it was sort of maligned at the time. And I feel like if you listen to indie rock from the 2010s, a lot of it sounds like Tango in the Night.
Yeah.
Tango in the Night ended up being a hugely influential record. And it just came out of this terrible period, where Lindsey Buckingham and Stevie Nicks were in a really bad way. And, Lindsey ended up leaving the band. We have to talk about how Lindsey Buckingham got fired.
Oh, yes. It was the most recent.
Lindsey Buckingham finally got fired from Fleetwood Mac. And by the way, Lindsey Buckingham was hired in 1974 and he got Stevie Nicks into the band because Stevie Nicks was his girlfriend. So now we flash forward
44 years later.
44 fucking years later. And I'm telling you, this is
the long con.
Shakespeare, people overuse Shakespearean as an adjective, but in this case,
it's
tragedy. It's apt. So Fleetwood Mac, they're playing, I think it's a Music Cares event.
Music Cares,
in New York. And before they come out, they're going to introduce the band to come on stage. And as they're walking out, they play Rhiannon, which is a natural thing to do, one of the most famous Fleetwood Mac songs. But apparently this really annoys Lindsey Buckingham. And I don't know, I don't feel like he rolls his eyes or something. He's kind of acting like a snarky asshole about it.
And Stevie's turn to speak comes up.
Yeah, and what is he, what did
he
Lindsey
starts
do?
He smirking. Right. And I guess Christine McVie and Mick Fleetwood start slow waltzing behind them. I guess it's an interband joke that she goes on for a while. I don't know. That's what they later said. His behavior at the Music Cares event apparently really, really annoyed Stevie.
And you also feel there's probably, 44 years of pent up. It's all the times, Lindsey Buckingham played Go Your Own Way, all the times he said that her songs weren't that good and he had to improve them.
A short fuse, yeah.
These things have been building and building, and she's I'm in a band. This is part of being in a band. I can tolerate this. And then finally, this Music Cares event is apparently the straw that breaks the camel's back because Lindsey Buckingham...
It's 2 days later.
2 days later.
He's
watching the Grammys.
Phone rings.
Irving Azoff, one of the most famous rock managers in music history. He's Fleetwood Mac's manager. And he calls Lindsey and he says...
You really did it this time.
Yeah, dude, Stevie never wants to be on stage with you again, is the quote. And what is kind of funny to me... And
it says so much.
It's kind of funny to me. It's also kind of heartbreaking. Lindsey Buckingham hears this and he's like, okay. And he doesn't really register that he's out of the band. A couple days later, he calls Irving Azoff back and he says, hey, wait a second.
Wait, when you said that stuff about
when you said that she doesn't want to be on stage with me again, did you mean that she's leaving or that I'm fired? He kind of thought well, maybe she's actually leaving and I'm still in the band. And Irving Azoff has to tell him no,
You've been ousted was the word apparently
used.
You've
been ousted. She gave them an ultimatum. She said it's him or me, and they chose Stevie. And Lindsey is gone. And that's kind of where we're at right now in this conflict. It's still simmering. Lindsey Buckingham ended up suing Fleetwood Mac for lost revenue.
They settled. They ended up settling. He claims that because part of the main hurt was that when he called Irving back was because he emailed Mick Fleetwood after the first phone call and basically said, oh, that's weird. Stevie's gone. And didn't get a response from Mick Fleetwood. And that's what made him think, oh, something feels weird here. And then he called Irving back and then, wait. She's leaving, right?
Oh, wait a second. Oh, she's leaving. Oh, cool. She doesn't want me on stage with me again? Okay, that's cool, man. I'll be at band rehearsal on next week. She's leaving, right? Or am I fired? And it's like, no, you're gone, dude. You're done. That's just brutal to me,
it's,
man.
And they apparently stop. And it's, you go through the lawsuit, and there's like he sends this like heartbreaking email to the band, lengthy, you know, pouring his heart out. At the very end, it says "sent from my iPhone," which for some reason cracks me up. It's like the screenshot of this email. And apparently, no one really wrote back to him. He got like two cryptic comments. I think he got like John McVie saying that he like wasn't allowed to speak to him. And then, but I guess after they settled, Christine said something to him about how, like, you know, Stevie, he says that Christine said, you know, Stevie, you know, I know on some level Stevie really wants, you know, wants you to come home, which is like, sure. Okay.
Well, that's the thing. I mean, because by the way, we should say that Fleetwood Mac did a tour with Mike Campbell from Tom Petty and the Heartbreakers.
Neil Finn
from Crowded House. Very successful tour. Sold out everywhere. I think they've toured around the world. I can only assume that that tour has made tens of millions of dollars. Like, people did not give a shit that Lindsey Buckingham wasn't on stage, which to me makes me sad because I actually—
Very sad.
I love Lindsey Buckingham. I've never seen Fleetwood Mac with Lindsey Buckingham, but I did see Lindsey Buckingham play a solo show 5 years ago in a high school auditorium.
Whoa.
Because he was doing this weird tour like where he was doing kind of like out-of-the-way music venues.
Where was that?
And it was in Wisconsin. It was in outside of Milwaukee, Wisconsin. And it was an amazing show. And the thing about Lindsey Buckingham is that when he plays Go Your Own Way for like the 10 billionth time in his life, his face has an intensity to it. It's like almost twitching with like energy and hate and anger and hurt. And it's like he is still reliving the emotions of that song every time he plays it. In the same way, I'm sure that Stevie Nicks still relives Silver Springs every time she sings that. And it's what makes those two, I think, still very compelling to people who are not baby boomers. You know, like you talk to younger people, you know, like Fleetwood Mac to me is like the one classic rock band that has most transcended the generation.
Oh, millennials love Fleetwood
Mac. Millennials love Fleetwood Mac. Generation Z loves Fleetwood Mac. You know, every you know, like Lorde talks about Fleetwood Mac.
Harry Styles
talks about Fleetwood Mac. You know, they've transcended. And I think part of that, along with just having great songs, is that sort of emotional authenticity. Like, they still have this sort of live wire soap opera quality to their music where you feel like they are living it still all these years later. And Stevie getting Lindsey fired from Fleetwood Mac just kind of fuels that more. It's like, no, asshole, I'm not over it. I'm not over all of the crap.
And I can do this to you. Yeah.
I can do this to you, man. And like, you know, going back to that quote, like, you know, about Go Your Own Way in Silver Springs, like where they each said, I want the person to hear this song and I want them to suffer. Every time this is on the radio, I want them to suffer. And I'm sure they do. So, you know, I mean, to me, like, I mean, do you think it's over?
I just can't believe it. It's over. Yeah, I can't.
I mean, I don't want to believe that this is the end of Lindsey Buckingham with Fleetwood Mac. I feel like there will be some reconciliation at some point. I have no basis to say that. And I would understand if Stevie Nicks really does feel like, you know, screw this guy. I don't want to be around him anymore.
But 45 years of history is telling you that something will bring them back.
Exactly. You know, really, like, the Music Cares thing is going to be the thing that ends this relationship. Like, really? After everything else, like, that's going to be the thing. That's the straw that breaks the camel's back. I mean, as successful as Fleetwood Mac was with touring with Mike Campbell and Neil Finn, that's not Fleetwood Mac.
No.
And I don't think, and I think if Lindsey Buckingham did rejoin, they could probably double the ticket price and people
would happily pay that.
You know, especially now, especially if you feel like they haven't really reconciled, but they're in the same band because they know it's good for money. You know, but they're still going to hate each other on stage. They're still going to play Silver Springs and like even have more hatred towards each other when they get
bile.
On stage.
Well, here's a hypothetical. I mean, kind of a silly one, but rewinding back to 1976, 77, if somehow they made it so that you knew nothing about their personal relationships at all, just the band released an album, how do you think it would have done? Rumors. Do you think it would have been this monumental, you know, record-breaking sales, you know, monolith? Or how do you think that their history would have changed if you removed the personal element from it?
I think it would have been a huge record because I think those songs are amazing and they would have been hits no matter what. I do think, though, that Fleetwood Mac would maybe be
Like Steely Dan sized instead of...
Well, yeah, I think they would be kind of talked about more in the context of like every other 70s band, you know, like a Steely Dan or, you know, like a Peter Frampton even, you know, like artists that were just hugely successful and are still played on classic rock radio. But like, you know, someone like Frampton, for instance, like there's no narrative to his career. Like there's really nothing that you could say about him that is interesting beyond the music. And really, that's also true of like Steely Dan, who's a band I love, but there's no really like interesting kind of larger narrative to their story. And like with Fleetwood Mac, I feel like that story, it just ropes people in so much. And it adds to the music because they're writing about it on their records. I think the fact that they come from like a real experience just adds to the resonance of that. And it never gets tired. And I think it doesn't get tired because of, you know, there's always more fuel.
There's always new, yeah.
There's always something else. We're going to take a quick break to get a word from our sponsor before we get to more Rivals. If you were going to make a case for Lindsey Buckingham coming out ahead in this feud, or if you're going to make the pro-Lindsey side, I guess, what would be your case?
I guess, I mean, I think how you feel about Lindsey Buckingham also, you know, is dictated by how you feel about Tusk. I feel like we haven't talked about Tusk enough.
Oh, man, yeah.
I think he sort of brought the...
Is that your favorite Fleetwood Mac record? I feel like it's become almost...
It's become the one to say, I think.
Yeah.
I mean, I don't know. It's definitely up there. I mean, I like how he was kind of doing the Brian Wilson, messing with the formula thing. How I guess there's a story when the first day that they went into the sessions, he said to the engineer, okay, set all the dials where you usually set them. Okay, now turn them 180 degrees.
Right.
And we're going to see what happens. And he would do, you know, put the microphone on the floor and get in like a push-up position and stuff.
It's like Lindsey, that actually sounds terrible if we do that. Everything sounds distorted and...
And one of them actually turns the machine off if you do that. So like, we can't do that with that one.
You've been playing for 3 hours. Right. You had to turn off the machines. Didn't record anything.
I mean, he apparently was in kind of rough shape during, I guess.
Have you seen photos of him at that time? Because he cut his hair.
Yeah, he freaked out in the shower and like nail scissors and cut all his hair off.
And he has like the owl's eyes, like where it's like dark, like rings around his eyes all the time.
Well, he's been awake for, you know, 2 weeks on.
Exactly. Yeah. That is like one of the great cocaine records of all time. Cocaine
Blizzard.
70s.
Yeah.
Just insane. I mean, when I listen to Tusk, I always hear it as like a Lindsey Buckingham solo record inside of a Fleetwood Mac record.
Yeah.
Because like the
way
that
it's more of their White Album kind of thing, well, where it's like a bunch of different artists just separately bringing their stuff.
It kind of like alternates between like these kind of classic sounding Fleetwood Mac singles like Sarah, and then it'll be like sort of like a bizarre Lindsey Buckingham song.
I mean, Tusk, the title track I can't believe that song was a top 10 song.
Or even like, you know, so I think songs like What Makes You Think You're the One, which felt like, that's like a Modest Mouse song, like 20 years before Modest Mouse. You know, there's like a lot of songs on that record, like the Lindsey Buckingham songs that sound like indie rock. They have like kind of the production style of indie rock because of the Brian Wilson thing, but also because he was really into like the punk music of that time.
Yeah, he was trying to do a post-punk album.
Doing a post-punk record. I mean, I think the case for Lindsey Buckingham is that he was the person most responsible for guiding Fleetwood Mac creatively through that sort of golden era from like 75 to 87, like as a producer and as an arranger of like other people's songs. And even on the song Silver Springs, the producer of the record, I think he's the engineer, Ken Callett.
Ken Callett, yeah.
He talks about just like all of these like guitars that...
The acoustic one, they would bring him a new guitar every 20 minutes because they wanted fresh strings.
Right.
Yeah, yeah.
And he kind of painstakingly overdubbed all of these great guitars. And I mean, that's an amazing song by itself, but like he really put a lot of care into like making that song sound as good as it could, even with the fact that that song's about him, you know, that he was able to do that. So, you know, as boorish as Lindsey Buckingham could be towards Stevie Nicks, and I think he could be pretty awful to her, he was, I think, the chief of that band. And I think he was acknowledged as such during their most commercially successful period. Fleetwood Mac is such a brand name now that maybe you can get rid of Lindsey Buckingham and a lot of people don't care. But I think for people that actually really love Fleetwood Mac, that is a pretty gaping hole.
Here's a hypothetical too. I mean, what if when Mick Fleetwood in 1974 went up to Lindsay and said, hey, you want to, you know, Bob Welch left, we need a new guitarist, you want to join? He just said, yeah, sure, see you, Stevie. How do you think history would have unfolded?
I mean, the answer to the hypothetical is that they would have not been nearly as successful without Stevie Nicks.
I think they would have sounded like America meets ELO.
Right. Which would be an awesome...
Which would be great. I mean, yeah, I would not...
I mean, I think they would have made really cool records with Lindsey Buckingham, but I think they would have been the kind of albums that people rediscover, you know, years later, in the same way that people do to the Bob Welch era and the Danny Kerwin era and, you know, Jeremy Spencer, all those like early 70s Fleetwood Mac records that weren't that successful at the time, but now people go back and they're like, wow, these are amazing albums. But you open the door to the pro Stevie argument, and I think it's a much more obvious argument than the Lindsey Buckingham one. I mean, she is the star of Fleetwood Mac. And I think that has really become, I think that was true in the 70s and 80s, you know, because a lot of the biggest hits were sung by Stevie Nicks. And she also had the biggest solo career.
As I say, you do a side-by-side of their solo career, it's, you know, you can't even compare.
You can't even compare. I mean, Lindsey Buckingham, I think, you know, in his defense, was doing something, I think, consciously different from Fleetwood Mac. He was kind of doing, like, weirder stuff on his solo records. Like, if you listen to, like, Go Insane, that's that Lindsey Buckingham record, which I think came out...
83?
It was, like, early 80s.
It was, like, right after Mirage.
You compare that to, like, Mirage. Like, Mirage is, like, a much more straight-ahead pop rock record. And then on his solo records, he's doing these sort of more bizarre experimental stuff.
And the interesting thing is, Go Insane is a breakup album, too. He had just broken up with his girlfriend in the 80s, the one who wrote a memoir recently, Sherry... I can't remember her name. But yeah, that was, he did a big profile on Rolling Stone, like Lindsey Buckingham, Lonely Guy or something was the headline for
right.
it.
Right. Yeah. That's a great profile.
Yeah.
I forget the lead exactly, but it talks about like, he's a great looking, rich guy, but he's like miserable, you know? And he's like living in this huge house in the Hollywood Hills.
I feel like his default state is miserable.
Yeah.
Is that fair?
Yeah. I mean, like I said, like when I saw him live, he was such an electric presence in part because there was something about him that seemed unsettled. Mm. You know, that he wasn't just like the typical rock star in his 60s who's kind of done it all and knows he can just phone it in. I didn't get that sense from him. And also the fact that he was playing this high school auditorium, because he had this speech about it at the beginning where he talked about Fleetwood Mac being this big machine. And that in his solo career, he kind of liked to be more almost like an indie rocker type guy. To kind of step outside the machine. I mean, ultimately, that might have also led to his firing from Fleetwood Mac, because it seemed like he was kind of holding the band hostage at times for, you know, wanting to do his own solo tours, and that would prevent...
And that was the official reason that the band kind of gave for why that was, that he wanted to hold up their tour to do like, solo stuff.
It's like, Lindsey wants to play high school auditoriums. Meanwhile, we want to make $1 billion on the road. This guy is holding us back. So fuck this guy. We'll go hire Mike Campbell and Neil Finn. That always blew me away, like how he ended up in Fleetwood Mac. I can get Mike Campbell because he's a guitar player. He's from, you know, he's part of that LA rock scene. Obviously, he has a history with Stevie Nicks.
Through Tom Petty.
Tom Petty. But Neil Finn, that just seemed like totally random. I don't know how the hell he ended up in the band. Because I think they actually played like Crowded House songs on that tour.
Oh, so they did like Ringo and the All-Star Band style where they like brought in his...
I think they did like Don't Dream It's Over.
Oh, okay.
I don't think they were going to like Woodface deep cuts. By the way, Woodface, that's a shout out for our Crowded House listeners.
Oh my God.
That's a good album, by the way.
Yeah.
So what is the case? And I think we've articulated this already. For Stevie and Lindsey to kind of exist in harmony, you know, like how do they ultimately complement each other?
The band Fleetwood Mac, I think their identity is wrapped up so much in the disharmony and dysfunction between those two. You know, as you said earlier, like what would the band have been without them? It probably would have been as they had been in the early 70s as just sort of a, you know, a Brit blues curio. I think so much of their identity is tied up in them together and their feud or their complicated relationship.
And it gives an edge to their music that it wouldn't have otherwise. I mean, a friend of mine recently described Fleetwood Mac as yacht rock. And I got into an argument with him because I was like, the thing with Fleetwood Mac is that even if their music is kind of soft, there's nothing smooth about Fleetwood Mac. Like Fleetwood Mac has always had this sort of rock and roll credibility because of the tumultuous nature of their history.
Oh, there's fire there, yeah.
There's fire there. There's like, you know, they might be beautiful pop songs, but like there's nothing sort of like contrived about it or manufactured. Like it's very raw emotionally, and it's drawn from like real heavy stuff that they sing about in a very sort of authentic way. And they obviously have lived it, you know, well past the fact of those hits, you know, and that's none more true than with Lindsey Buckingham and Stevie Nicks. You know, they still are hating each other, which also makes me think that they must also seriously, like, really lust after each other in some way, too. You feel like that fire is there, too. If they still can get it up to have this sort of rancor, then they must be able to get it up in other ways. If we can, if I may put it somewhat indelicately, you know, there's a real passion that still exists with them. And I just hope that it's not the end. I hope that there is some sort of way to get them back in the same band where they can barely tolerate each other for another, you know, however many years.
Hey now, don't dream it's over. In the words of
Fleetwood Mac's Neil Finn. Yeah. So, okay, I think that's the big thing. Stevie, Lindsey, get back together. Keep hating each other. For us at Rivals, I think we'd appreciate it. We need you to keep
hate each other
rivalry.
Hate each other together, please.
Hate each other together, please. All right. Well, I feel like we could talk about this forever.
Oh, I don't want this one to stop.
But I feel like we have to wrap it up. So this has been Rivals, and it's always fun, Jordan, talking with you. And we'll talk to you again next week.
Thank you, sir. Always a blast.
All right. Take care.
Rivals is a production of iHeartRadio.
The executive producers are Sean Titone and Noel Brown.
The supervising producers are Taylor Chacoin and Tristan McNeil. I'm Jordan Runtog.
And I'm Stephen Hayden. If you like what you heard, please subscribe and leave us a review.
For more podcasts from iHeartRadio, visit the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to your favorite shows.